this planet Earth. You're looking at planet Earth. Bop, 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 bop. This is planet Earth.
We're now continuing season four of our Planet Earth series, a series in which we look at how space technology is helping us understand our home planet. This is episode 53.
Planet Earth is blue.
Well, last week there was a launch, delayed by weather, but got away eventually, from New Zealand. Yes, from New Zealand. And two American satellites were launched for NASA, and we were there, well, virtually. And here's how things went at Rocket Lab in New Zealand.
It's Friday, May 26th here at Rocket Lab Mission Control as we await the liftoff of our 37th Electron launch, once again from Pad B at Launch Complex 1. Hello and welcome to Launch Day. You're joining us live for our broadcast of Coming to a Storm Near You, a dedicated launch for NASA to deploy the second half of the TROPICS constellation. I'm Imogen Ray.
And I'm Keegan Black, and we're excited to have you join us for another TROPICS launch. It's also an extra special day for us here at Rocket Lab as we celebrate the 6th anniversary of Electron's first launch. We're targeting liftoff for 3:46 p.m. New Zealand time.
Today's launch is the second of two for NASA to deploy the TROPICS constellation, which stands for time-resolved observations of precipitation structure and storm intensity with a constellation of small sats. This innovative constellation of four CubeSats will monitor the formation and evolution of tropical cyclones, including hurricanes, and will provide rapidly updating observations of storm intensity.
This data will help scientists better understand the processes that affect these high-impact storms, ultimately leading to improved modelling and prediction to help save lives. We are so proud to be supporting TROPICS and grateful to be once again working with our mission partners at NASA.
Just over 2 weeks ago, on May 8th, Electron lifted off for the first of these two dedicated launches and successfully deployed two TROPICS CubeSats to a 550-kilometre circular altitude above Earth at an inclination of about 30 degrees. All four of the TROPICS CubeSats need to be launched to their operational orbits within a 60-day period, but the sooner the better, which is why we're back on the pad just 18 days later, ready to go to space again.
TROPICS has been a massive team effort, with the science team led by the Lincoln Laboratory at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and others including researchers from NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and several universities and commercial partners. So with one launch down, we're excited to get the next away today ahead of the North American hurricane season.
Just like our first TROPICS launch, today's mission is flying from Pad B at Rocket Lab Launch Complex 1, our private orbital spaceport on New Zealand's Mahia Peninsula. As we approach the final minutes in the countdown, our launch operators at Range Control in Mahia and here in Rocket Lab's Mission Control are working through their final checks before liftoff. Commanding this overall effort is Launch Director Julia Vembacher.
Shortly, Julia will ask all operators for an update on their launch status to determine if they are good to proceed with today's planned launch. This is called the go-no-go poll, where operators will indicate if their systems are green, go for launch, or red, which means they're working an issue.
No-go sequence is now complete. We are T-minus 11 minutes and 58 seconds in counting. We are go for terminal count at T-minus 10 minutes. From this time, the three-way procedure is in effect.
Fantastic news there from Mission Control. All greens across the board, which is what we want to hear. We are go for launch, which means we are coming to a storm near you very soon indeed. We're on track for a liftoff of 3:46 p.m. New Zealand time today.
Today, with this TROPICS launch, we're also celebrating a special anniversary for our favourite rocket. On May 25th, 6 years ago from Launch Complex 1, Electron took to the skies for the very first time. As it crossed the Kármán line and completed a perfect first stage burn, stage separation, second stage ignition and fairing separation, Electron became the first orbital class rocket successfully launched from a private launch site and opened up a new era in regular and reliable launch for small satellites.
The flight also ticked a few other world firsts. The first launch for an all-carbon composite rocket with the world's first 3D printed engines powered by a completely new electric pump-fed cycle. 36 launches and 161 satellites deployed to space later. Today we're ready to launch our latest pair of sats to space on Electron and wish it a very happy 6th launch anniversary as it flies.
Today's launch will be our 37th Electron mission, but the way we go to space for the two TROPICS launches is a little different from a standard Electron mission to low Earth orbit. The launch follows a standard format for the first 6 or so minutes of the mission. Electron will lift off from the pad thanks to the 9 Rutherford engines on the rocket's first stage. These engines will burn for around 2.5 minutes, lofting Electron to about 90 kilometres above Earth's surface. From here, Electron's first and second stages will separate, with the spent first stage falling back to Earth. Shortly after this, a single vacuum-optimised Rutherford engine will ignite on Electron's second stage to propel the kick stage and TROPICS CubeSats for another 7 minutes, positioning them at that 550-kilometre altitude.
This is where the mission departs from our standard format. Typically, Electron's second stage takes the kick stages and payloads to an elliptical orbit, and we use the small 3D-printed Curie engine on the kick stage to circularise the orbit. For the TROPICS launches, the second stage is used to circularise the orbit, and instead, the kick stage's Curie engine conducts what's called a plane change manoeuvre to position the TROPICS CubeSats at an inclination of 30 degrees, the best spot for monitoring the formation of tropical storms. Here's more from Guidance, Navigation and Control Team Lead George Buchanan.
I'm Dr. George Buchanan, Guidance, Navigation and Control Engineer Team Lead, but you can just call me George. The GNC team, Guidance, Navigation and Control, is in charge of making sure that Electron gets to the right orbit. So the inclination of an orbit is the tilt. So a 0 degree basically means that you're going all the way around the equator. 90 degree means that you're going up and over the North Pole and the South Pole. So with a normal Electron, we'll go to a transfer orbit with our stage 2. So that means that we're in around about the right orbit, but slightly too low, and then we use our kick stage just to boost us up before we deploy payloads. So for TROPICS, we've got to do a couple of sneaky things. So firstly, we do a dogleg, which is basically where our trajectory actually bends around, and so we head up north rather than heading out east, and then we sort of curve as we're flying. And then the second thing which we have to do is we use our kick stage to do an on-orbit inclination change, which basically tilts the orbit which we're in to be in the right one. So for TROPICS, between liftoff and payload deployment, most of it will look very similar. However, what's a little bit different for TROPICS is that we'll be at the right altitude already. You'll see that we're much higher than normal. So we go into a coast until we get close to the equator, and at that point our kick stage will light its Curie engine and do an inclination change. We'll actually be pointing sideways and burning sideways. So we'll be travelling up along this way and actually thrusting at right angles to that, which is highly unusual, but it's what you need to do this change. Shortly after that, we'll do a payload deployment. And so we'll actually be deploying outside of ground station range. And so we won't have live confirmation of that until we get over our ground stations in Europe. Yes, so we've done this manoeuvre before. In fact, we did it for the first TROPICS mission just a couple of weeks ago, and we expect it to do exactly the same thing. We'll head up north, do a dogleg, inclination change, and deploy some more satellites into orbit. What the kick stage gives us is a lot more flexibility on orbit, and so we can do a lot of missions which a traditional large launch vehicle may not be able to do. So we can wait before doing burns, we can light up to, you know, dozens of times with this little kick stage, and we can point it in any direction we want to. It's also fairly flexible because it's this photon bus, we can change it. So sometimes we'll add additional batteries so we get a longer mission, or we'll change the amount of RCS if we want to do a lot more manoeuvring and pointing. When a customer comes to us with some interesting requirements, then we sit down as a team and work out how we can get Electron to meet these. And so this will be doing a bunch of simulations to make sure the trajectories will get us to the right orbit. We'll also run tests on actual hardware to make sure that we can meet any requirements that way. Sometimes we'll do things like change the design of the vehicle, so we'll be talking to other teams. And this is something which Electron, being quite customizable and being really agile, is great for. Yeah, I really love these science missions. Being able to do something which you know is actually going to have a really positive impact on millions of people, it's something really special.
To everyone on mission code, we are go for autosequence start at T-minus 2 minutes. LDS go for launch.
Vehicle is on internal power. AFTS is green and ready for launch.
LOX load is complete. System is in recirculation. Anti-geysering is disabled.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
discharge nominal.
And that is a beautiful liftoff for Electron. The final two Tropic satellites are on their way and coming to a storm near you.
And that launch was successful. The two satellites were deployed into orbit, in the correct orbit. And then we had to wait and wait and wait because they didn't get a signal at first. And then they got a weak signal. And the last announcement that I saw, which was yesterday, was that they were still hoping to get a signal from the satellites. I haven't looked today, so hopefully they've picked up the signal. But if not, well, that's the way it goes sometimes. You're listening to The Space Show, and hopefully next week we'll better tell you whether or not those satellites are in contact or not.
88.3 Southern FM.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
The four Tropics satellites are each about the size of a loaf of bread. This size is called a CubeSat. Now, NASA is making significant investment and progress in demonstrating the technical and scientific capability of CubeSats. In the past, satellites used to monitor the Earth's environment had a mass ranging from hundreds of kilograms to several tons. The advent of microelectronics meant that these missions can be packed into a cube as small as 10 centimeters on each side. For example, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's RAIN cube has been in orbit for 3 years. The goal of the mission was a 3-month technology demonstration. It used precipitation profiling radar with two new technologies developed by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. These were a miniaturized atmospheric radar and a deployable antenna. Throughout the mission, RAINCUBE provided high-quality images of precipitating structures ranging from hurricanes to winter storms. In many cases, these storms were observed coincidentally with RAINCUBE's sister CubeSat, Tempest D. Now, Tempest D was a technology demonstration to enable multi-frequency millimeter wave technologies on a low-cost, short development schedule. RAINCUBE also completed the first ever in-space demonstration of techniques essential to enable a new generation of cloud and precipitation radars. This has already helped shape the vision for the next major NASA mission concept. The aerosols, clouds, convection, and precipitation satellite will, as its name suggests, target clouds and precipitation. A RAINCUBE provides valuable insight for mission concepts under study by NASA and commercial ventures.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
Globally, freshwater lakes and reservoirs hold 87% of our planet's liquid freshwater. Furthermore, one quarter of the world's population is living in a lake basin. So, when a team of scientists report in the respected journal Science that more than half of the world's largest lakes and reservoirs are dwindling, we have to sit up and take notice. The scientists from the United States, France, and Saudi Arabia used 5 satellites to look at the Earth's 1,972 largest lakes by surface area. The satellites were ICESat, ICESat 2, Landsats 5, 7, and 8, and Cryosat. The ICESats and Cryosats use a LIDAR, to measure the elevation of water surface. The LIDAR shoots a pulse of light from a laser and measures how long it takes for a reflection to be received back at the satellite. Knowing the speed of light and the position of the satellite allows a calculation of the elevation of the reflective surface. The Landsats use photographs which are measured to calculate changes in lake surface area. The satellite data used in this study was collected between 1992 and 2020. The scientists found that 53% of lakes and reservoirs had a decline in water storage at a rate of about 22 gigatons per year. In all, 603 cubic kilometres of water was lost over the study period. Now, by way of comparison, Lake Hume holds 0.003 of a cubic kilometre of water when full. That's 3 gigalitres. For natural lakes, the net loss is attributed to climate change and human water consumption. Warmer weather leads to increased evaporation. Some reservoirs are filling with sediment, reducing their storage capacity. The study included 18 reservoirs in Australia. In addition to the satellite data, gauge data from organisations such as the Bureau of Meteorology was used in the study. Now, over in the United States, they have a Space Council, which is overseen by the Vice President, Kamala Harris. At last year's conference, they mentioned the Landsat satellites in a report from the United States Geological Service.
I'm pleased to be representing the Department of the Interior today. USGS took over the controls of the Landsat 9 satellite from NASA last month, and we are looking forward to continuing that 50-year record of great Earth observation images. The new capabilities of Landsat 9 allow us to better track and understand the consequences of global climate change in order to help people on the ground operate their businesses and protect their citizens. Last week, during World Water Week in Stockholm, we heard from two farmers, one from Oregon and one from California, who told us how they use Landsat 9 images to evaluate the crop use, the water use of their crops, by verifying the evapotranspiration rates that they're seeing and allowing them to use less water, especially important now during these drought times. We're also using Landsat 9 to document the historic 20-year drought that we have in the Colorado River Basin, and to see the rapidly changing conditions in our river systems and glaciers, documenting the historic floods we're seeing around the globe, and predicting future sea level rise. Landsat 9 images also allow us to detect water quality changes in things like harmful algal blooms that we see in lakes that affect our drinking water supplies. All of the Landsat data is available for free for anybody, whether you're a government agency, a business, a school, or a family, anywhere around the globe. Those images are used in commercial activities such as Google Earth and Planet. They're also used to help our research priorities for our STEM programs and mentoring opportunities such as the Ladies of Landsat. We are very excited about the announcement yesterday with our partners at Commerce on the camera climate mapping tool, which is another great example of how we're using our new technology and working together for the benefit of the American people. Thank you very much for your leadership, Madam Vice President.
And for folks who are listening right now, how would they have access to some of this information? Where should they go?
We have it widely available both from NASA and the USGS through our Landsat.gov programs.
Never without a website. Thank you.
Don Graves is the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Commerce, and he told the Vice President about NOAA's activities on the environment.
I want to start, if I may, by highlighting the work that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, at Commerce, is leading on climate data. NOAA, as you know, is the nation's Climate Agency, working closely with our partners at NASA, and we're working hard to build a climate-ready nation. So just this week, as Tanya mentioned, in collaboration with the White House, with ESRI and the Department of Interior, NOAA released the Climate Mapping for Resilience and Adaptation, or CAMRA, portal. The tool will help Americans assess their local exposure to climate-related hazards and identify potential funding that can help them protect people, property, and infrastructure. Space-based technologies, including remote sensing data produced by NOAA satellites, have dramatically enhanced scientific understanding of our changing natural environment. And as you've heard, Landsat and other satellite remote sensors measure surface skin temperature.
Yeah.
That's roads, rooftops, canopies, and forest canopies, whose temperature can be significantly hotter or cooler than the temperature that people in these places actually experience. So NOAA is adding to this data with on-the-ground measurements. It's our most innovative program, and we work with community-based groups in underserved communities to map the hottest parts of cities so they can use that information to inform strategies to reduce the unhealthy and deadly effects of extreme heat.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're wondering about how you can get that information.
Absolutely.
You can. More information on extreme heat is available on NOAA's heat.gov website.
Bill Bruno is with the Department of Agriculture, and she explained how the department uses space data.
Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, Jewel Brona, please talk about how the Department of Agriculture is helping farmers deal with increasingly what they are seeing in terms of floods and drought. Can you talk a little bit about how the Department of Agriculture and your leadership is having an impact on that?
We recognize that this administration has allowed us to focus on some really important things: planet-wide food security, global agricultural practices, climate change in space, and you mentioned drought and other disasters. We have really been able to focus on land-based conservation practices, and they will be directly dependent upon our ability to furnish and integrate space-based data layers into climate conservation practices using tools such as ESRI and Landsat data.
Right.
We can utilize that data to address a myriad of issues, including how our land is doing to deal with disasters such as drought and others, agricultural production and other things, and it's really allowing us to focus on a lot of work that we're doing in climate smart agriculture. So we need our farmers and landowners to have solid data.
Yeah.
And they need that data to make decisions. It's going to help them have the capability of integrating space-based data into their precision agriculture innovations.
Mm-hmm.
So we are very excited to be able to have resources mm-hmm. from this council and the science that we need to deal with the challenges that our farmers face every day.
And, you know, the astronauts that I spoke with this morning who are on the International Space Station made a real point of emphasis on just that type of work and the importance of it, and including what I know that the Department of Agriculture is doing in terms of working with NASA to develop crops for long-duration space missions, which is very exciting as well. So thank you for that.
And those three clips courtesy of the White House. A geodesy is the science of measuring the size and shape of the Earth. The use of satellites has a key role to play in this. There are two major goals of geodesy. One is monitoring the mass transfers within the Earth system with increased precision. The other goal is realization of the reference frame. To this end, the French National Space Agency has proposed a single mission satellite called MARVEL. The name is an acronym for Mass and Reference Variations for Earth Lookout. Scientific objectives would include measurements of geodesy, hydrology, cryosphere, oceanography, earthquakes, and post-glacier rebound. All of these are seen to be highly relevant to society. That's been our look at planet Earth.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.